debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. There is something I don't understand, and maybe you can help me with this. In Utah, in the state of Utah, the good people of Utah put a ballot initiative on their ballot, which was, yes, we're going to take the Medicaid expansion. Keep in mind, you know, the federal government pays, I think it was 90% of it. The state only has to pay 10% of it. So the voters of Utah put this on the ballot and voted it in. You know, legislature wouldn't do it. The governor wouldn't do it. They're all Republicans. So the citizens of Utah said, we want the Medicaid expansion. It's going to give health insurance the ability to get low-cost health care or no-cost health care to 150,000 people in Utah. To do that, it's going to cost the state nothing for the first couple of years, but they say that it's going to cost around $10 million by 2021 and $65 million by 2024. Okay, so keep that in mind. $10 million, like a couple of years down the road, it's going to cost the state of Utah. Utah has, right now, a $1.2 billion surplus. $1,200 million, right? It's got a $1.2 billion surplus. And the Republicans who run Utah are saying, we're not going to put into law this thing that the people just voted on. There's legislation to completely repeal the ballot initiative. There's legislation to impose work requirements like they've done in, you know, a number of other Republican-controlled states. You must work if you're going to get Medicaid. There's a bill to cap enrollments. There's only a certain number of people who can get it. There's a bill that would lower the income thresholds so fewer people qualify. I mean, four different specific pieces of legislation in Utah right now where Republican legislators are saying to the people of the state, tough luck. You know, you guys voted to have health care for everybody in Utah, and we're going to take it away. Now, I suppose this isn't all that surprising. I mean, this is what Republicans have been doing, right? I mean, the whole Tea Party thing was, we don't want no stinking health care. But the question in my mind is, why? I'm wondering, is there an answer that's not the facile answer of, well, Republicans are stupid, or Republicans don't think that people should have health care, or Republicans think that if people don't earn their health care, they don't value it, or if they don't pay for it, they don't value it? Or is it that Republicans like the fact that when people use the emergency room as their primary health care, that they're more likely to get really serious diseases that ultimately kill them and they're not going to get checkups. And I mean, you walk into the ER and say, I think I've got a bump someplace or a lump. And they're like, you know, come back when you're bleeding. Right? It's emergency care. So maybe Republicans like the fact that people not having health care actually drives up health care costs. Every cancer diagnosis adds about $500,000 to the GDP of our country because, you know, there's all the stuff that goes with the cancer diagnosis and cancer treatment and all that kind of thing. Of course, that's ignoring the lost wages, lost work, the lost productivity. But why are the Republicans in Utah doing this, in your opinion? Why do you think they're doing it? Do you think that they're doing it because they're evil? Do you think that they're doing it because they hate poor people? Do you think they're doing it because they've got some bizarre ideology? Does it have to do with their Mormonism? Except that this is not unique to Utah. I mean, you know, a number of other states have done the exact same thing or something very close to it. The Republicans in other states. Why do Republicans, in the case of Utah, Utahans, not want Americans to have health care? Why? I don't get it. Why? I get, you know, why somebody like the Koch brothers doesn't want anybody to have it, why they funded that campus group that was doing the creepy Uncle Sam ads and all that. They don't want their taxes to go up. But they're billionaires. It's, you know, the legislators in Utah are not billionaires. I don't get it. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Hi, Dr. Tom. I don't know if you got to see Robert Reich on MSNBC last night talking about universal health care.
I did not. Which show was he on?
I don't remember. They all run together.
They all blur together, yeah. I pretty much only watch Rachel's show in the evenings. But
anyhow. Yeah, she was pretty good last night. Yeah. But most people don't even stop and think about the fact that we already have 5 government medical programs. Medicare, Medicaid, Children's Health Insurance Program, TRICARE, and the VA.
Right.
And we have 5 bureaucracies to handle this. I have a neighbor. She's a state employee, current working state employee, needs an MRI. Blue Cross said she couldn't have one. She's in excruciating pain, and she is down there sobbing on the couch this morning because of the pain, and she can't have an MRI to find out what's wrong.
That's insane.
It's disgusting.
That's insane. And you know, four of those 5.
This has to do with profit. It's all profit. And these greedy people, if they can't get by on $21 million a year, which works out to a little over $10,000 an hour, which is, you know, a salaried employee gets paid the first day of the year, even though it's a national holiday. That means he gets paid $40,000 the first morning of the first day of the year, and he didn't even go to work. And another $40,000 in the afternoon.
Right.
And you wonder why people can't afford health insurance. If a person had one, say a married couple, at least one paycheck a month goes to health care, that means they cannot save money and buy a house. That means that they cannot develop equity in their family. They can't buy a new car. They can't buy a better grade of washer and dryer, and why should they if they don't own the house?
They can't put their kids through college.
And they cannot put their children through college. Everything here in Alabama is taxed. I pay 10 cents on the dollar for food, for food. But we cannot tax the stock market, even, you know, like Bernie was talking about, 0.001% to create a fund for free college.
Yep.
Yeah, but instead we have a dozen greedy men who own or control the health insurance industry who are making billions out of the population, the entire population, every year. And this is keeping the country poor, and this is also financial segregation. You're not good enough to have health insurance unless you pay me a great deal of money. And so what are we supposed to do? Get down on our knees and beg, please, Mr. Rich Guy, let me go to the doctor?
That's exactly what we're supposed to do. That's what they want, in my opinion.
We are not serfs. We were born free.
Yeah, well.
We have rights. And if they don't wake up and stop this and give us one universal health care program, call it the Department of Health in, you know, health care for the United States,
right,
whatever they want to call it, and get people to the doctor. I would like to go out to eat again, but I don't because I don't want TB sauce on my salad. We've had 8 outbreaks of TB here in Alabama.
Tuberculosis.
Yes, tuberculosis.
Wow.
active live tuberculosis.
And this is because people don't have access to health care. I mean, this is a public health crisis as well.
When
you've got in the state of Utah, you got 150,000 people who are uninsured, and you have a TB outbreak. You know, they're not going to do anything about, oh, I'm coughing.
How about the person that cleans the rich man's office, the rich man's bathroom? How about the person who puts a pair of glasses on your face when you need a new eye frame? How about the person who cleans your teeth? How about the person who cleans your child's school? This goes on across the entire fabric of our country. And this is causing a health crisis, but it is also financial snobbery, financial segregation. Oh, they're not good enough. They don't work hard enough. I have a new family across the street, four black people. They have six jobs between them because the two boys are going to school.
Wow. Wow.
Six jobs. And yeah. If I hear one more person tell me how lazy the black people are, I'm probably going to hit them because I'm sick of it.
Yeah.
When I was listening to the guy, Rick, yesterday, I was almost ready to cry. But also, how many times does a white person say, hey, let's sit down and have a cup of coffee? Let's talk about some things. How often does a black person do it? We have to start talking to each other.
Yeah.
We cannot keep segregating people and hating somebody because they look different. We're human beings. And this business of segregating people because you're not good enough for this and you're not good enough for that has to stop.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and very well said, Norma. Thank you very much. Jim in Belvidere, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, I totally agree with your last caller. My point is sort of similar. My employer pays $44,000 a year for our health and welfare, including our pension.
Wow.
That's per man.
Wow.
And it's a Teamster, it's a union job, or a union company, but our numbers have diminished. Our pension plan is in turmoil, and wouldn't it make sense if we had Medicare for all? That would defray the cost of the health care to the employer,
right,
to where he could pay better wages and offer a good pension fund.
This is why Canada has a higher standard of living. It's why Canada has lower infant mortality. It's why Canada has lower maternal mortality. Canada has a longer lifespan because everybody has health care. And on the higher standard of living, everybody has health care through a single-payer plan that doesn't skim 20% off the top so a bunch of health care billionaires can have a ninth or tenth mansion in Sweden or Switzerland or whatever. Charisse in Poulsbo, Washington. Hey, Charisse, what's up?
Hi. First, I just wanted to say quickly that if people wanted to learn more about the America's influence on other countries, democracies, and et cetera, they should read Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Oh, yeah, by John.
You know it. It's amazing.
I know John,
and
yeah. What's his last name? Perkins, that's right, John Perkins.
The healthcare thing, I still would like an answer to the question of why corporations and businesses, big and small, don't lobby Congress to have universal health care just so they can get that cost off their balance sheet.
It's a good question, Charisse, and I don't know the answer to it. I remember when Toyota was going to build a new plant in North America, and they ended up taking it to Canada, and they came out and made a public statement that there's $2,600 worth of health insurance in a car made in the United States, and there's zero in one made in Canada, or maybe it was a couple hundred bucks that they had to pick up the part of it. You would think the GM would be saying, hey, we want to compete, you know, it's like, and every other company in America. And plus, you know, then you get into things like, you know, this whole debate about whether people should have sick time and things like that. Well, you know, do you really want to go to a restaurant where they don't offer health benefits to their employees and don't give them, you know, sick time off so that, you know, they're sneezing in your salads before they deliver them to you? I mean, it's just like there's a public health dimension to this. There is a business dimension, as you correctly point out. You know, I would love not to have to pay for health insurance for all of my employees. We might be able to expand the show. I mean, there's things that we could, you know, use that money for. It's just crazy that we've got this system. We're the only out of the 34 industrialized countries in the world. We are literally the only one that has for-profit parasitic companies sucking money out of healthcare. Charisse, thank you for the call. And this is like, how did we get to be the world's village idiots? Well, you know, I think a lot of it probably had to do with the Supreme Court saying that corporations are people and money is speech, and billionaires can buy politicians.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, a number of people asking this question, why are they doing this in Utah, have said, you know, follow the money. And there you go. let's see here, John in Cumberland, Maryland, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Listen, I was a student of American literature as an undergraduate. That's what I got my degree in, specifically, you know, studying Herman Melville.
Uh-huh.
And there is plenty of Calvinist, you know, references in Melville's Moby Dick, but we had to read all of the early Congregationalist ministers' sermons as part of the curriculum. And I see this fundamental link between John Calvin and the Protestant Reformation and Calvin's doctrine of the elect.
Right.
And, you know, Calvin maintained that although no one can presume to be saved, wealth is a likely indicator of God's will.
Just calibrate me on this, John. My understanding of Calvinism, of John Calvin's theory, was that kings of Europe had always said, we're the ones that God chose because we're in charge. And basically, they just acquired their power by being the most vicious warlords around and then ultimately the richest people around. And so the challenge for Christianity was, if you believe that somebody has to be in charge of government, and this was, you know, when the idea of democracy was considered absurd. If somebody has to be in charge of government and you want it to be somebody that God has blessed, how do you know who God wants to be in charge? And John Calvin said, basically, well, the way you know who God wants to be in charge is you look at who God has blessed. And, you know, he obviously blessed these rich people, so they must be the good people that we can put in charge. Is that a good summary of it, John?
And even to today, you'll have rich people talking about, you know, we're blessed.
Oh, look at Howard Schultz, the Starbucks guy. I mean, you know, I saw him on Morning Joe day before yesterday. I was like, my God, this guy thinks that he is God's gift to America.
Right, but this goes right down to the roots of our culture, and it's the link between fundamentalist Christianity and the right, because, you know, these New England ministers wrote extensively about this in terms of God's new covenant, and frequently cited out of the Bible is 2 Samuel 7:10. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they shall move no more, neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them as before times. So this is fundamental stuff, and I don't think you can get down to the truth of what's going on unless you get down to the roots of the culture and the language that accompanies it.
So you see this as the reason why these good Mormons in Utah said, no, you can't have health insurance if you're poor?
I'm not sure how connected the Mormons are to Calvin and his doctrines, but I do know that fundamentalist Christianity, you know, is very connected, you know, to the doctrine of the elect.
Yeah. It would be interesting to know, you know, what percentage of the Republicans in the Utah legislature are Mormons versus fundamentalist Protestants. And I think you're right, John. I think that you've got one of the larger pieces of this answer to why would the Republicans do this, and it's because they're pursuing, you know, Calvinist theology, a Calvinist idea. Betsy DeVos, by the way, I'm pretty sure is a Calvinist. You know, the Calvinist Church is big in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I think it's their headquarters here in North America. John, thanks for the call, and thanks for the clarification there. That was a very clear articulation of what we're talking about. Everyone's talking about the decline in stock values over the last few months. If you've been listening to Lynette Zhang's YouTube show, you probably aren't surprised by the fall. Her fact-based research on markets, currencies, and economics is second to none. And her presentations have pointed to most every major downfall we've recently seen in the U.S. economy. Her video titled Just Before the Crash showed people the exact patterns to look out for, and now has over 210,000 views and counting. Lynette Zhang has been on my show and works with my friends at ITM Trading. I highly recommend looking them up, as they are pioneers in creating wealth protection strategies with gold and silver. If you're a strategic investor looking to protect your wealth or just hedge against the most volatile markets since 2007, then call my friends at ITM Trading at 1-888-OWN-GOLD. Ask for their free gold protection guide and join the top 1% who are now accumulating very specific types, dates, and qualities of physical gold and silver. Call 1-888-OWN-GOLD. That's 1-888-OWN-GOLD.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Michael in Snohomish, Washington. Hey, Michael.
Yeah, I disagree with it about how you say the Republicans hate the poor people.
Well, I didn't say they hate them. I'm just wondering, is that what causes them to say, no, poor people, you may not have health insurance?
Well, they're doing everything they can to make more of them.
More poor people.
Poor people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You have to have a huge servant class to run your estates and the sweatshops.
You're right. See, you think it's, you know, we want to have more poor and desperate people. Those poor and desperate people then are going to become cheap labor for us. You know, the pool boy's not going to charge as much.
Well, pool boy, heck, that'd be a good job. The poor, what they want, that you can't be the Crawleys without a whole bunch of servants to run your Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't want Daisy to get a typewriter and find a new job. They want her scrubbing floors.
Right. Well, you know, actually, there's, you know, your position, you know, the guy who called before you was saying it's all Calvinism, you know, this idea that God has blessed rich people, you know, and they're supposed to run society. And the obvious evidence of that is their riches. And that is the basis of, you know, one of the major Christian denominations, keep poor people in eternal servitude. Yeah, makes sense. Michael, thank you. Robert in Sacramento. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
I think the question is pretty simple. The Republicans, they hate poor people.
And, so this is simply punishing people for being poor. You may not have health insurance because you're poor, period.
Right.
Where does that hatred come from?
I thought maybe you could explain it.
I can't. I mean, you know, my dad was a Republican. I never heard him say anything, you know, bad about poor people. I just don't... You know, I get that it's happening, right? I've been doing this show for 15 years. I'm watching this happen. I've been watching it happen my whole entire life. I watched this happen, you know, when Reagan came to office. You know, we can't have people going to college for free. You know, that's a terrible thing. And I get that they've got some weird philosophy that if you don't work for things and if you're not indebted to your employer and all this kind of stuff, and it seems like kind of a plantation mentality, plantation owner mentality on the part of the Republicans. But I, you know, where this comes from, you know, what's the deeper thing? What's the deeper meaning? What is this coming out of? What would cause somebody, what would cause a Republican, a middle class Republican in the Utah legislature to say, the people of this state said that they want to have Medicaid expansion, but I'm going to deny that to them? I don't get it. Charles, in South Dent, California? Charles?
Well, that's Southgate.
Southgate. Oh, okay. So what's up, Charles?
Well, I was just going to say that I talked to you about 2012, 2013, and told you that I didn't have insurance. And found out I had some cancer. So I went to, I didn't go to Cobra, but I went to the state of California. And they sold me a pretty expensive policy. I figured I could, like, handle it, you know, for about a year anyway. Mm-hmm. So I got treated, and right in the middle of my treatment, they canceled my insurance. They said, well, you can go with a federal program.
Oh, my.
I said, well, okay, what's the deal on that? Well, the premiums are going to be higher, plus your deductible doesn't count anymore. Hmm. I'm like, geez, I can't do that. So anyway, what I'm saying is universal health care would be a great thing, you know, from birth to death.
Yep.
Because, you know, if you have good doctors, they could, like, you know, diagnose things before they got too bad.
Yep. Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And also, you know, once you've got a system like that, everybody gets that if everybody's healthy, that's better for society. And so there's even less of an incentive, frankly, like the Republicans every year, they try to cut the VA budget, or at least the VA hospital budget, because they want the service that the VA offers to be crappy service so that people will complain about it. This is what Republicans do, break government and then complain about it so that it becomes a profit opportunity. And in fact, that's what Trump is doing right now. He's privatizing the VA. Charles, thanks for the call. Tom in River Falls, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, this thing with the Utah, with the Medicaid, it all comes down to that these cons don't like democracy. And I'm going to prove it to you. I was listening to the Dennis Prager show today, and he keeps saying this. He says the libs or the leftists, they want to control you through big government, and we conservatives want liberty and less government. And if I could have called in, I would have said, no, actually, less government means less democracy, which means less liberty. Right. We have to use our frame, and don't use the frame government, but use the frame government. And every time I debate conservatives, I always, when they say, "Oh, big government, I hate government," I always say, "Why do you hate democracy?" I didn't say that. Yeah, you did, because our government is democracy. We the people.
Right.
You act like government is something outside of us, like an autocratic government in Russia. Then I would agree with them. Okay, government is evil, but our government, it is us. We the people, right? So I always use our frame and put it, let them be defensive and say, no, you don't like democracy. Why is that? And let them try to defend that. And it really puts them in an awkward position.
Yeah. And you've been singing that song on this show for 15 years, Tom, if my memory is accurate.
And then even look at Pelosi and Schumer during the shutdown. They kept saying government. He's closing government. They should have said our government.
Right.
And they didn't do that. And then this bumper sticker that you were looking for last week on how do we say free healthcare, because that word free is kind of loaded, and it gets the conservatives always, well, nothing's free in life. What do you mean free? So what I think we should do is just say Medicare for all, publicly funded, just like our fire, police, education, highways, et cetera. That would fit on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Because everybody agrees with our publicly funded, stuff, right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's that metaphor that I constantly default to, which is, if we collectively get together and fund the fire department to make sure that our house doesn't burn down, why don't we collectively get together and fund the medical department to make sure that our bodies don't burn down? I mean, is our house more valuable than our bodies? Really?
But that, I agree that we shouldn't use the word free, because that gives them the upper hand, saying nothing's free in life.
Yeah,
right.
Well, and it's not free. I mean, we're all going to have to pay taxes and all. It's just we'll spend less than we're spending right now with these parasites, with these health insurance companies sucking the blood out of all of us. Maine in Chicago. Hey, Maine, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I wanted to talk, a bit about, economic freedom. What's happening here in America is economic slavery. This is what continues when you have trickle-down economics. When you can get the people to believe that less is more, that 3 plus 5 is 8, but 5 take away 3 is 2, and you say that is more, when you can convince people like that, then you come to the point where you can say corporations are people too, my friend, have the people to believe that. And because of these philosophies that have gone down on the right wing, because they're the ones that have been truly pushing economic slavery, the oligarchs, big business, collaborated with one another to where they are the party of the rich.
No, I think your point is well taken, Maine. Basically, what has happened in America is capitalism has turned into serfdom, and Reaganism is the big catalyst for that, to turn people basically into wage slaves, into economic slaves. And the more that you can take away people's benefits, and this might have something to do with what's going on with the Republicans in Utah, the more you can take away the social safety net, the more you can take away the net that catches people when they fall, the more vulnerable people feel, and the more likely they are to just do whatever the boss man says, and go to work for Starbucks or Amazon or some incredibly crappy job for that matter. And because it's all that there is anymore. And, without a decent minimum wage and without a chance to have any kind of benefits or anything, people will still do that. And that's crazy. Spot on, Maine. Well said. Anna in Moorhead, Minnesota. Hey, Anna, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better, Anna. How about you?
I'm doing well. I was calling about, you were talking about what's going on in Utah, how the state legislature is trying to undo the will of the people.
That's correct.
From the vote. Well, they're doing it in North Dakota also.
Hmm.
The voters of North Dakota on the last election created an ethics commission to look into some of the shady dealings that were going on. Now the state legislature wants to undo it.
Wow.
And I don't know if you're familiar with a man named Joel Heitkamp. He's the brother of the former senator from North Dakota.
Okay.
He's a radio personality here in the Fargo area, and he was laying this out pretty well, that there's a number of state legislators who are not happy that the people want to have oversight
right
over what's going on.
Yeah, well, this is Mitch McConnell's complaint about H.R. 1. Oh, my God, transparency? We can't have transparency. We're Republicans.
Well, we can't have will of the people in democracy either, because supposedly this is a republic.
Yeah, yeah. Spot on. Anna, thank you for sharing that. I didn't realize that was going on in North Dakota. I'm going to have to learn a little more about that. Sharon in Sandstone, Minnesota. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Have I got you?
You do. What's up?
Well, I wanted to call because you know how the opposition is always turning words and accusing us of doing nefarious things that they are actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think we got to start turning some of these things around and using them against them. Like, we believe in a right to life, as in the Constitution, and that encompasses you got to have health care, you got to have food, you got to have shelter, and you have to have a living wage to have life.
Yes. And this is, by the way, I'll bet most of these Republicans who are trying to refuse health insurance to 150,000 Utahns, I'll bet most of them call themselves pro-life.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, really?
Well, we are pro-life, too. But we believe in health care, food, shelter, and a living wage.
There you go. Amen. Sharon, well said.
If you had all that, you wouldn't have to surround abortion clinics if people had a decent living wage and health care and shelter and food.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. And these are important points, by the way. Sharon, thank you for the call. The pro-life position, you know, pro-life sounds so nice. But let's talk seriously about what that means. What does it mean to actually support life? Why is it that the United States has one of the worst infant mortality rates, has the most worst infant mortality rate of all industrialized countries? Why do we have some of the worst poverty in this country?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Could it have something to do with the notion that raw, unrestrained capitalism is antithetical to life? Don't you just love it when something that's already amazing gets better? Well, that's the case with the X Chair. The makers have taken what is arguably the most comfortable and supportive office chair in the world and made it even better by introducing wider seats in the X3 and X4 models of the X Chair. That means extra support for those of us with wider bases. The good people at X Chair are constantly innovating to help improve your working comfort and productivity. And now you can finance the purchase of your X Chair for as little as $30 a month. Seriously, for less than the cost of a daily cup of coffee, you can make 2019 your most comfortable and productive year ever by getting yourself an X Chair. X Chair is on sale now for $100 off. Just go to xchairtom.com, that's xchairtom.com, or call 1-844-4XCHAIR. X Chair comes with a 30-day no questions asked guarantee of complete satisfaction. Go to xchairtom.com now and use the code Tom, T-H-O-M, and get a free footrest. That's xchairtom.com. A couple of stories here that I think are just absolutely fascinating. Beyonce and Jay-Z are offering fans a chance to win free tickets for life to their concerts in exchange for adopting a vegan diet for a month. Beyonce is pledged to eat plant-based breakfasts and go meatless on Mondays, while Jay-Z is promising to eat two plant-based meals a day. That's kind of cool. And on top of that, Cory Booker declared that he's running for president today, and he's a vegan. So we now have a vegan candidate for president, which puts him real high on my list of good guys. You know, Big Pharma notwithstanding. Continuing this conversation, we do a book report every day. And on our nonprofit stream and on Free Speech TV, they play while our commercial stations are doing the news at the top of the hour. And the book report that we rolled out yesterday was Handbook for a Post-Roe America by Robin Marty. I think Katha Pollitt's blurb on the front cover, "The Future Without Roe is Coming Straight at Us. This is a roadmap you need for the tough times ahead," is, you know, a really great summary of the book. And I thought it was just a marvelous book. And I wanted to get Robin on to talk about this book, The Handbook for a Post-Roe, R-O-E, as in Roe v. Wade, America. The book is from Seven Stories Press. And Robin Marty's Twitter handle is Robin, M-A-R-T-Y. Robin, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tom.
It's great having you with us. So tell us, how certain are you that this particular Supreme Court is going to overturn Roe v. Wade? Or is it that the individual states are taking actions right now that are functionally doing that, and nobody is stopping them, so we don't even need the Supreme Court to screw it up?
Well, I would say that the states are functionally stopping abortion from being accessible for the most part, but I do believe that this Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade. I would suspect that the actual overturning would happen as late as or as soon as after the next presidential election. I do not think that they will overturn it before 2020 because they know that if that happens, there is no way they would keep the White House. But I do believe that after that has settled, that yes, Roe will be overturned.
That's amazing. So what will that mean for women in states like California, New York, where abortion is still available, or in states like Louisiana, you know, where it's very, very difficult to access abortion?
Right. So we're going to have a patchwork, even more so than we already have, of states that will primarily be either on the east or west coast, and then basically Colorado and Illinois, where abortion will be legal and accessible and people will be able to get it. And then for the rest of the country, we'll see at least 15 states that will have abortion completely illegal, and then probably another 15 to 20 where abortion will be mostly illegal, and you will only be able to access it at maybe one or two clinics in the state, and probably in as little as 6 to 12 weeks.
Isn't the functional outcome of that going to be that we are reverting back to the pre-Roe standard, essentially, of wealthier women, upper middle class and wealthier women can easily access abortion? Women who don't have access to money basically can't. I remember being in high school, you know, I remember one girl in particular who was in my high school who I didn't know particularly well, but one day she just stopped coming to school, and we later learned that she had died. She had had a back alley abortion and became septic and got an infection and literally just died in one day. And on the other hand, I remember a couple of different people that I knew, and this was back in the 60s, right? This was the late 60s, who had what were called DNCs. And the excuse was, I was having hard periods. And so they go in for this process where they basically scrape out the inside of the uterus. And in fact, usually the DNCs being done in the 60s were actually early stage abortions. And, you know, if you could afford to go to the hospital and have a DNC, no problem. Is that the kind of thing we're going to go back to, or is it going to be even worse than that?
Well, see, I would argue that we're already there right now. For many of the states in the U.S., especially in the southern portion of the U.S. and along the Gulf, we only have one, maybe two abortion clinics in each of those states. They're very overfilled with patients. Abortion is still a fairly expensive procedure that a lot of people cannot obtain. So we are seeing people who already are living in states where abortion access is just for the white and for the wealthy. In some ways, I actually believe that having Roe overturned might benefit the country, because when abortion is completely illegal in these states, and then it is difficult even for those of privilege and those with money to be able to access, then people will see the real live impact of what it's like when there is no access to abortion. Once it affects everyone, then I think that everybody will start to go ahead and gather together and do more political force to make sure that abortion becomes legal once more.
Speaking of this strategically, we used to have conversations, debates about abortion on this program, you know, for years, obviously. I mean, it's a hot topic. It's been a hotter topic in the past. But Phyllis Schlafly used to come on this show a lot, and she, of course, yeah, I get it. And, you know, she and I actually agree on a couple of things that have to do with the Supreme Court, which has made for some fascinating conversations. The argument that she made against Roe v. Wade, though, I thought was actually a fascinating argument. I'd love to get your take on it. What she said, essentially, was that the birth control pill was legalized in 61, or was brought to market in 61. By 63, 64, birth control pills were widely available all across the United States. And that produced the so-called sexual revolution, women coming into the workplace in larger numbers, all these kind of things were happening. And that by 73, the trend line was very strongly in favor of individual states legalizing abortion. And in fact, it was starting to happen. And a debate was starting to break out in individual states about, do we legalize abortion or not in this state? And that when the Supreme Court stepped in with Roe v. Wade and simply legalized abortion nationwide with a very specific criteria, the first 3 months, the second 3 months, the third, you know, these trimesters, that essentially her argument was, A, they were making law, you know, and I don't think that we can dispute that, you know, coming up with the three trimesters. That's what a legislature is supposed to do. There's no constitutional basis for that. And B, by short-circuiting that legislative process around the country, they shut down the conversation and they empowered the radicalized portion of the anti-abortion movement in a way that nothing else could have empowered them, and delayed, in fact, by generations, a healthy legislative process that would have this debate, this discussion that you and I are having. What do you think about that?
Not to be rude, but that's totally wrong.
Okay.
All right. To start with, the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade did not come up with the trimester system. That was in Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 92. And the trimester system says that abortion should be accessible for any reason in the first trimester. In the second trimester, the state's decisions to try and promote fetal life should be able to, they should be able to put in restrictions as long as those restrictions did not make an undue burden and were in the benefit of the of the health of the person who is trying to obtain the procedure. Roe v. Wade essentially said that until the point of fetal viability, which at that point was considered around 28, 29 weeks, that abortion was legal and up to the person who was going to have one. After that, abortion would only be legal in cases where a person's physical or mental health were in distress. And so a provider decided that that was in the person's best interest to go ahead and obtain an abortion. So we tend to get these mixed up. And
yeah, thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about quite a lot lately, when you look at the fight that's going on right now in New York, the huge brouhaha that just happened in Virginia over the idea of all of these bills in Virginia, in New York, in New Mexico, all they are trying to do is codify the protections of Roe v. Wade because they believe that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned. So they are using the exact same framework as the courts decided in Roe v. Wade, which is that until the point of viability, it is up to the person who is going to decide to have an abortion. And then after the point of viability, it's available for health reasons, physical or mental. All they are doing is codifying Roe v. Wade. Now, if abortion opponents really believed what they've been saying for the last 30 years, which is that they don't want to stop abortion per se, they just want to send it back to the states, then they would be letting these states make these decisions. But instead, they're making up all sorts of asinine discussions about how people are saying that these new laws will allow doctors to abort children at the point of crowning, and it's infanticide and all of that. And I think they're really showing exactly how they really don't believe that, no, the state should not decide. All they want and all they've ever wanted is complete illegality for all abortion from the point of fertilization. And that's where they're going to keep going. Everything else is just smoke screens that they throw up.
Now, Pat Buchanan used to speak out loudly about this. And the subtext that I got from his writings and rants, and he'd been on our show back more than a decade ago about this, was that basically he was opposed to abortions among white people. He didn't care about abortions among people of color. Is there a large sector of the anti-abortion movement that is also concerned about what Buchanan referred to as the white genocide?
I would say no. I spend a lot of time with anti-abortion people. I go to their conferences, I go to their marches, I spend time with them in front of clinics. For the most part, they are all extraordinarily sincere. They believe that life begins at the moment of fertilization, and anything that a person does in order to try and disrupt that is playing God. And that's what it all comes down to for them. Now, we are starting to see more of a right-wing white nationalist influence into a lot of the abortion movement, and I think that there have been a number of, especially Christian nationalists, who have kind of combined this white power feeling of, okay, we want to make sure that white babies are saved into it, because there's a common ground there in making sure that babies are saved. But I don't think that overall the majority of the movement cares about what race they're saving. They just want to save their babies.
Fascinating stuff. Robin Marty is the author. The book is Handbook for a Post-Roe, as in R-O-E, Roe v. Wade, a Post-Roe America. Robin, brilliant work, brilliant writing. Thanks for educating me today, and I appreciate your being on.
Thanks for having me on, Tom, anytime.
My pleasure. You can tweet Robin at Robin Marty, R-O-B-I-N-M-A-R-T-Y.
Tom Hartman.
With all the recent news about online security breaches, it's hard not to worry about where my data goes. Making an online purchase or simply accessing your email could put your private information at risk. You are being tracked online by social media sites, marketing companies, and your mobile and internet provider now that the Republicans have destroyed net neutrality. That's why I decided to take back my privacy by using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of my computer, phone, and tablet. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. Protecting yourself with ExpressVPN costs less than $7 a month. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/Tom. That's ExpressVPN.com/THOM for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/Tom to learn more. Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is by Robin Marty. It's titled Handbook for a Post-Roe, as in Roe v. Wade, for a post-Roe America. And the cut line on the front says, the future without Roe is coming straight at us. This is the roadmap you need for the tough times ahead. This is from Chapter 7, page 101, titled Knowing Your Comfort Zone, Why Civil Disobedience. Access to abortion and birth control isn't just a health care issue and an economic issue. It's also a civil rights issue. And like every civil rights battle, gains are made through acts of civil disobedience or working outside the legal framework. Married people officially gained the right to access birth control only after Estelle Griswold, the executive director of the Planned Parenthood League of Connecticut, opened a clinic and began offering contraception in direct opposition to the 1960s state law forbidding it. That right was extended to single people in 1972 after Bill Baird was arrested in 1967 for purposely flaunting the Massachusetts law and publicly providing contraceptives to an unmarried woman during a college lecture. The Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion spent much of the 1960s and early 70s prior to the Roe decision assisting pregnant people in finding safe abortions either from legal or illegal providers throughout the country and across the borders. And there were groups like Jane's Collective that provided the service themselves, even at the risk of their own arrest. Today, people are highlighting a number of issues through acts of civil disobedience. North Carolina had weekly mass arrests at their state capitol during Moral Mondays protests, while the Black Lives Matter movement physically closed highways with their bodies. And of course, when Brett Kavanaugh was appointed to the Supreme Court, hundreds of activists were arrested, some multiple times. Aaron Mattson, the co-founder of the reproductive rights group Repro Action and Teen Vogue, wrote, if Roe is overturned or gutted, it is certain that some states will propose and enact some abortion bans, new abortion bans. Again, nonviolent civil disobedience should remain on the table, this time targeting state and municipal level lawmakers. We must remember that while in several contexts, abortion rights supporters lack immediate political power, in spite of the fact that nearly 7 in 10 Americans do not want to see Roe overturned, we always retain the power of using our bodies to stop or slow the machinery of state repression. End of quote. Mattson adds, ultimately, it's up to activists to decide. Are we willing to break convention if lobbying fails? Are we willing to strategically expose ourselves to the risks of arrest? And if we are not, are we willing to look into the eyes of the future generations who will be incarcerated for abortions, miscarriages, and pregnancy complications? End of quote. Repro Action is a growing network of state-based activists that conducts political events, teach-ins, and other direct actions to increase access to abortion and birth control services. They currently have national campaigns as well as individual campaigns in D.C., Virginia, Missouri, Arkansas, and Wisconsin. You can join up with or financially support Repro Action to increase their national and local reach. Subchapter title, Is Civil Disobedience Right for Me? What are you willing to do to make sure that you, the people you know, or even total strangers have access to contraception and abortion care, especially once more abortion options become illegal? Are you willing to be arrested if you participate in direct action or nonviolent protest? Is helping someone obtain abortion pills worth a potential prison sentence? Would you drive a teen to another state to get an abortion if that drive makes you an abortion facilitator and thus a federal criminal? You may believe you're willing to risk everything to help someone get an abortion, and that may well be what is needed in some cases in a post-Roe America. But make sure that you've really thought out all the consequences of such a radical approach. These are the questions you should be asking yourself now before new laws are put into place. One small silver lining of the Trump era is the way it has energized so many people to actively resist the political agenda. It's almost impossible to be a solitary activist these days, but there are spaces where you can manage. Letter writing campaigns, social media campaigns, information distribution, and fundraising can all be accomplished in a fairly solitary environment. Handbook for a Post-Roe America. Hey, we have a whole bunch of special content just for our Patreon supporters over at patreon.com/TomHartman, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's. It includes the entire 3 hours of our program every day. The entire program is available there that you can watch. Patreon.com/TomHartman. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot going on in the news and in the world today. There is a case going before the Supreme Court that is testing whether the good citizens of New York City, who through their elected representatives, through a democratic process, chose to say to gun owners in New York City, you may have a gun in your home for your own self-defense or for, you know, sport in your backyard or whatever it may be, or in your living room, but you may not carry that gun anywhere outside the city, through the city, unless you're going to one of 7 designated gun ranges in the city. That's it. And the folks who think that owning a gun is an absolute right, like the right to have health care, or the right to housing, or the right to a job. Oh, that's right. We don't have any of those rights in the United States. Well, anyhow, they think that this is a God-given right, are saying, wait a minute, you're restricting our rights. One of those folks is Cam Edwards. He's the host of Cam & Company on NRA TV. NRATV.com is the website. You can tweet him at Cam Edwards, C-A-M Edwards, just like it sounds. Cam, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much, Tom.
So here's what I don't get. Number one, it sounds to me like you're opposing democracy. You're saying the will of the people be damned. My gun is more important than that. And then secondly, we've got 34,000 people a year in the United States who are shot. And I just can't wrap my head around the idea that the profits of the NRA and the gun manufacturers that support the NRA are more important to Americans than the lives of 34,000 people. What am I missing here?
Okay, so we can talk about that, but I thought we were going to talk about the Supreme Court case. And actually,
well, this is the Supreme Court. You're trying to say that you're trying to overturn a democratic process by use of the courts. Are you not?
Well, I'm not a party to the lawsuit, but yes, the plaintiffs are, in fact, trying to overturn a New York law. And, you know, just a reminder, Tom, that, yes, local control is very important, but the Supreme Court has already said in the McDonald case, which came out of their opinion in 2010, that it's not just the federal government that cannot infringe on your right to keep and bear arms. State and local governments can do that as well. So the question that is before the court right now is whether or not that law in New York violates not only the Second Amendment. This is sort of a three-pronged argument. So there's the Second Amendment argument. Then there's also a Commerce Clause argument. And then there's also a right to travel argument. Because this law is unique to New York City. It's not just that the people of New York City decided, you know what, we want this law to be on the books. They're the only people in the United States that has decided, we're going to require you, as a legal gun owner, somebody who's already gone through the permitting process, somebody who's gone through the background checks, who's gone through character references, who could be denied for any reason or no reason whatsoever, but we've approved you, we're now going to require you to, let's say, leave that firearm in your unoccupied home while you go off to your weekend place in Woodstock.
This is a law that seems to be hitting the hardest people who have second homes.
No, not necessarily, because one of the plaintiffs here also is a resident of Staten Island. He has one home. But the nearest range to him would be outside of New York City. So he's not actually allowed to travel to his closest range, even though the city's argument is that there's a public safety benefit.
So the poor guy has to drive an extra 10 or 15 miles to go play with his gun.
Well, the argument by New York City is that this is somehow going to reduce road rage by having an unloaded, locked up firearm with your ammunition stored separately. That's how these firearms have to be transported. We're not talking about carrying firearms for self-defense. We're talking about transporting a firearm. The same way that you transport a firearm when you go to the airport and you put your checked luggage on an airplane, the city of New York says that's not good enough. We don't trust you.
So my original question, Cam, we're talking to Cam Edwards of NRA TV. My original question, just very straightforward, 34,000 people a year being shot in the United States to protect the profits of this industry. And then this industry saying, wait a minute, you know, you may want to have rights like, you know, the right to have health care if you get shot, but we're not going to help you with that. We're not going to advocate for that. You might have the right to have a home, but no, not, actually, we're not going to support that. You may have the right to a job. No, we're not going to support that. But you do have a right to a gun and to carry a gun around. And we're going to defy the will of the people of New York City who voted for this, who voted for the elected representatives who passed this. This seems to me like the most bizarre perversion of a value system in my lifetime. And I'm just shocked by it.
All right, let me try to brush away the strawman that you've created here. I'll try to get to my answer. So first of all, let's talk about the number of firearm victims that we have in this country, which is down, Tom, by about 50% since the early 1990s. Now, gun ownership in the United States, we now have more than 300 million private.
You're talking
firearms.
About crime, not people being shot, because if you include accidental shootings and you include suicides in those numbers, the numbers have actually gone up since the 90s.
Accidental shootings have dropped since the early 1990s. Suicides by firearm have gone up, but suicides by means other than firearm have actually increased at a greater rate. So this is not a gun issue. You want to talk about a mental health issue?
I still think it's a gun issue. If you look at Australia, when they essentially made it very difficult to own a gun and dialed back the number of guns in circulation, they immediately saw a 14% drop in suicides. Over a number of years, it's been an almost 50% drop because, you know, somebody's depressed.
You know what the drop was before that gun ban went into effect, Tom?
I don't.
Interesting. Okay.
To the best of my knowledge, there was no drop. The simple reality is if somebody is depressed and they're contemplating suicide, you know, if they're going to have to go through a whole lot of hassle and it's going
to
be very painful.
What does this have to do with the question before the court? Because the question before the court is not whether or not you should be able to own a gun. The court has answered that question. So what does this have to do with the question that's before
the court? Well, the court has not. Okay, very simply, Cam, the court has not specified that this is an unlimited right, the right to own a gun. It is a right that can be constrained in a reasonable fashion by state, local, and federal governments, as you know.
So you think it would be reasonable to require a gun owner, regardless of whether or not they live in New York City, anywhere in the country, that they could not remove that firearm that they legally own from their home unless they're going to a pre-approved range?
I think it depends on where you lived. I lived in Vermont for 10 years, and there's virtually no gun laws in Vermont, and there's really no problem with that. People get it. But in New York City, it's a whole different thing. And I'm a fan of democracy, small d democracy, okay, and a small r republic. And I believe, I agree with Thomas Jefferson, that the people themselves should be the source of all law, or the most law, and that when the people of New York City say, this is how we want to conduct ourselves relative to guns, and historically the Supreme Court has said, this is not an unlimited right. It is a right that can be constrained within a whole bunch of different contexts. It just seems reasonable to me to say, what's wrong with democracy?
Well, I got to tell you, Tom, I'm coming to you from Virginia today, and for a good portion of the 19th and 20th centuries, in the name of democracy, we saw an awful lot of people have their constitutional rights denied. So the argument that this is simply democracy doesn't fly with me, because democracy can still infringe on individual rights, and that's the question before the court. Now, you may not like the right that we're talking about. You may not even think that it's a right. By the way, you would be surprised if you would actually look at gun owners as individuals instead of the elaborately constructed straw man, that there are gun owners that believe in universal health care. I don't. There are gun owners that believe in, you know, a guaranteed job. I don't. But you just didn't acknowledge that because you...
No, I'm talking about the NRA, basically.
Who were in favor of this lawsuit were the gun industry. Not gun owners, the gun industry. We're talking about individuals who have brought this suit, Tom. And again, you may not like this right, but it is a real right. It does apply to all Americans.
I think, Cam, to always say, you know, we once had slavery in America. Cam, to go to, and I've had people do this before, to say, oh, well, you know, democracy is all well and good, but it brought us slavery, therefore we shouldn't have democracy. Are you proposing instead that the NRA should be making our laws?
We have a legislative process.
Well, that's democracy, but you're arguing that that legislative process should be overturned by the courts.
Of course not, Tom. Again, I don't know why you're having me on if you just want to put words in my mouth. Well, what I'm suggesting...
I'm trying to understand.
...is that, okay, so we don't have nationwide a democracy. We have a republic, right?
Well, we have both, actually, and the two words were largely interchangeable.
You know how bills get made. Bills get made. Both sides lobby. Michael Bloomberg spent $100 million on campaigns last year trying to get candidates in office who will support his anti-gun bills. We've got bills actually coming up in New Mexico right now, universal background checks. So both sides lobby, okay?
But so, Cam, will you join me in trying to put an end to that?
No, I don't have a problem with both sides.
You don't have a problem with people buying political... Oh, geez. Okay.
Okay, so once the bill has become a law, that bill can then be challenged. That law can be challenged, which is what's happening here. So... if you're talking about this being some sort of a challenge to democracy, I'd say that you're arguing against checks and balances.
I am simply saying two things. I'll go back to them again. It seems to me that the lives of 34,000 Americans a year is more important than the profits of the NRA and their gun manufacturer supporters. And that if the citizens of New York want to have a very restrictive gun laws, they should have the right to do that.
Okay. And that's your opinion. And I'm sure there might even be, you know, hopefully not five justices on the Supreme Court that would take your side. I'm hoping that, you know, there's no more than four. But you may very well find justices that would agree with you on that.
Well, we'll find out.
I think that...
We'll find out how it shakes out. Cam, we're out of time. Cam Edwards, his show is Cam & Company on NRA TV. You can find that on the web at nratv.com. His Twitter handle is Cam Edwards. Cam, thanks for dropping by.
You bet. Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's been 9 years since the Supreme Court has heard a Second Amendment rights case, and they're pretty giddy about this. The NRA is really good at cherry-picking these kinds of cases. The one in D.C., the Heller case, for example, where you had an off-duty cop who couldn't take his gun to work or home or whatever it was because of D.C.'s highly restricted gun laws. And in this case, they found a few people in New York City, same thing. And what they do is they go, you know, okay, this is an absurd law, but instead of just chipping away at that law, they are looking for much broader things, which is exactly what they got in Heller, where in the Heller decision, Scalia literally went back trying to claim that he was speaking on behalf of or speaking about, you know, the founding generation and all this. And the founders never talked about guns for self-defense. I mean, they literally never talked about it. It's not in the constitutional debates. So anyhow, the founders did not talk about protecting family in their debates around guns. It was almost entirely around slave patrols and militias. You know, Patrick Henry and George Mason and these guys, they were very, very flipped out that they might lose their slave patrols, and thus they had to have the Second Amendment. So, you know, here we are. But Scalia, in the Heller case, he found this old, today's equivalent of a brochure from the 1790s, as I recall, that mentioned something about hearth and kin. Didn't have anything to do with guns, but it mentioned hearth and kin. And so Scalia started using this phrase, hearth and kin, throughout the Heller decision, like, I'm channeling the 1700s. And, of course, it was BS. It was a lie. But that was Scalia. So, anyhow, these guys say this is a gun rights case. They want the Supreme Court to hear this. Of course, that's going to happen. Will it pave the way for new Second Amendment cases? They think, yeah, you know, now we can start taking on some of these challenges. Who are the parties? Were you one of the parties that was sued, et cetera? So anyhow, that's what's going on with the gun rights thing. Jim in Poway, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? The NRA just drives me crazy, but they are in a losing end, and I'll tell you why this is. One of the largest gun shows in America was the Crossroads of the West at the Del Mar Fairgrounds. This year, they just canceled it.
Really?
They are running scared.
Wow. That wasn't in response to a change in the law or anything. It was just...
No. They just... The local people... You know, California's fairly progressive, and they just decided this is not something we want to honor.
Wow. That's amazing.
When you have a country where we have more guns than people, there's a problem.
Yeah, I agree. Well said, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.